Very special event here at Sunset Gita with our guest Bhakti Charu Swami. Would you please join me in welcoming Bhakti Charu Maharaj to our Sunset Gita program? Thank you so much. This was totally unexpected. It was a chance visit, and we immediately seized on Bhakti Charu Swami to be our special guest here. I'll do a more formal introduction after we have an opening kirtan. All right? So if you'd like to lead us in a kirtan mode.
Thank you. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Should we put this down, or would we like to leave it up there? Should we bring it down so you can see Maharaj better? So I have a brief biography of Bhakti Churu Swami. You have to tell me if it's out of date, but I'll read it. His Holiness Bhakti Churu Swami was born in Bengal in 1945. That probably has not changed. He spent most of his early life in the city of Calcutta. In 1970, he left India to study in Germany. While in Germany, he discovered India's millennial wisdom texts and the richness of India's spiritual heritage. In 1975, he returned to India to pursue a spiritual path, and the following year he received Diksha, or spiritual initiation, from A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada in the Vaishnava lineage.
His divine grace,
A.C. Bhaktivedanta. And soon after, he entered the renounced order of sannyas. In 1996, Bhakti Churu Swami took on the mammoth task of producing a 65-part television series on his guru's life and teachings. The series, called Abhay Charan, premiered on India television and has been seen in more than 20 countries. Bhakti Charu Swami developed a major cultural complex in Ujjain, India, which recently opened, was it?
No? 2006.
In 2006 it was inaugurated. He travels frequently and is a popular speaker on Indian spiritual paths. So would you please join me once again in welcoming our guest, Bhakti Charu. The way we're going to do this, and those of you who have been here for other such interviews are familiar with the format. I get to ask whatever I want because I'm the big guy over here. And then we're just going to open it up very quickly to questions and answers. Rather than a formal presentation, this is an opportunity for all of us to ask about the things that are important to us, what's on our minds, and Bhakti Charu Swami has very kindly agreed to make himself available to us for that purpose. I wanted to start by asking you, you and dare I say we are part of an older generation of, now an older generation of Bhakti practitioners. What do you think has been the biggest change that you've seen since you contacted Srila Prabhupada and the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, going back to the 1970s? In the interim, this is more than 40 years approximately or more, what would you say the biggest change has been in all that time?
Well, when we were young, the world was very different. And especially, America was going through a very, very unique phase. I mean, the way I actually perceive it, you see, after the Second World War, America actually rose to its height of material prosperity. But the youth of America became disillusioned. They saw that money cannot buy everything. And you are a product of that generation. Like, they felt that money cannot buy love. And that's why they kind of rejected that culture, and they started to look for something that is meaningful to them. And that's how it started, the counterculture. And, well, they were searching, although their search was not really proper at that time, but they were searching, and it's during that time that Srila Prabhupada came to America. And a group of young boys and girls actually responded to Srila Prabhupada's call. And a new era started. And we got caught up. Well, I mean, like, this is my observation of the American situation. But one thing I can say, that even in India I was affected by that. Like, I read books like On the Road by Jack Kerouac.
You read Kerouac's book?
Jack Kerouac. Dharma Bombs. And anyway, and of course the music, the Beatles, Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, Woodstock Festival, And that was, I mean, the way I would say that is the way we were feeling at that time. But then the change came. Mid-60s, it went, I think, say up to 80s. But then another culture started. Then that generation, I mean, after that, they started to aspire for material prosperity. That rejection of the materialistic culture turned into a rather appreciation for material prosperity. And that's the trend that came in, and it prevailed for some time, maybe for, I think generally this kind of things last for about 25 to 30 years.
Yeah, that's the cycle.
And I think now the world is changing again. Mm-hmm. I mean, now they are again searching for spiritual counterpart, or the spiritual goal of, like, you see, two things are existing side by side, material and spiritual, matter and spirit, body and soul. So sometimes the tendency is towards the matter, sometimes the tendency goes towards the spirit. But in a way, I feel that the tendency now is more towards, tending towards the spirit, or spiritual aspirations and development.
Yeah, that's a very vivid description, I think, of what we've witnessed, you know, in this lifetime, the cycles of dissatisfaction over the war years and the consumer culture of those days, moving into that searching period of the 60s, and then growing up, moving back into the world. Perhaps, do you think it was because people got tired of the spiritual search, or was it that they never found what they were looking for, so they went back because of by default?
You get frustrated with material and then you aspire for spiritual, but you know, like a group of individuals get carried away and continue into that direction. But some may not, and like I think if I'm not wrong, I mean I hope I'm correct, that from hippie culture it came to EFP culture, right?
To which culture?
EFP, YEWP.
Oh, yippee.
EFP culture.
That came and went pretty quick, the yippies.
Yeah. And anyway, I mean, what I was actually pointing out, that, you know, like, I feel very impressed the way the Western world is taking to yoga, vegetarianism, which is actually leading to that spiritual world. Yeah.
We're finding that. We're finding that the level of questions and discussion and dialogue that's taking place these days in yoga studios is so much deeper than it used to be. Something happens, you start that practice, and then it stimulates a desire to go deeper into the philosophy and into the spiritual knowledge. So I'm curious about something else as well. You do a lot of travel. I mean, you always have. You started by, as a student, going to Germany, you know, from the kid. Do you find that the devotional culture, the philosophy side of yoga practice, is the same from country to country, from culture to culture? Are there cultural differences when you travel?
Well, I will say that there are two sides. One is Eastern and the other is Western. The Eastern side is dominated by the Indian, you know, Indian approach to it, or Indian understanding of it. And the Western world, at least today or nowadays, is being dominated by America. So these are the two predominating factors. The yogas are coming from India, but the world is accepting it today because America has accepted it. America is promoting it. And the thing is, the goal is, I think, the same, in the sense, you know, I'm saying that the American side of it, the American side of acceptance of the yoga, or American purpose of accepting the yoga, is rather material, you know, physical well-being, you know, mental peace and tranquility. But, you know, as you know, that the goal of yoga is not just that. It's much higher than that. The purpose of yoga is to bring you from material to spiritual plane.
like the body and the soul. Everyone is concerned with his body or physical existence. But this body is alive, the body is conscious because of the presence of the soul. So the spiritual objective is to understand the soul and become situated on that spiritual identity and pursue that goal. So the general tendency of yoga today, I may be wrong, but I mean the way it seems to me, mainly, basically, is not really absolutely spiritual. Therefore, there's a need to remind the practitioners that, you know, the actual goal is not just physical well-being and the mental tranquility, but to, you know, transcend. I mean, not just be physically feel good, but transcend the physical platform and become situated in a platform where you are not only feeling good, but you're feeling blissful.
Hmm. It's funny about feeling good is that people don't generally talk about how little satisfaction there is in it. And that we were discussing this earlier, that when you enter into bhakti life, you go deep into the philosophy, and what you find is that the whole notion of tranquility kind of disappears because you're thrust into a mood of action, of moving into the world deeper than before.
Right, yeah.
I remember our dear godbrother Karandar from many years ago was walking with Prabhupada and said to him, why is it that my life before I became a devotee was so peaceful? I had everything together. Everything was organized. And I had my act together. And ever since becoming a devotee, my life is so chaotic. Nothing works anymore. And Prabhupada's answer was, well, it's like cleaning your room. When you first start to clean your room, the furniture is out of place and dust is flying everywhere. But you know that by this cleansing, when it's done, it'll be cleaner than it's ever been.
Very good. Yeah.
So it seems as though things are actually more disturbed. And there's something about becoming comfortable with that discomfort that seems to come with serious yoga practice and an understanding of bhakti. Would you agree with that?
Sure.
You've put yourself to quite a bit of discomfort in your career as a bhakti teacher, haven't you? You've never taken the easy path.
It's because it's something like, I was just, you know, what actually immediately came at the back of my mind is the occupation of a doctor, right? The doctor's business is to cure the patients, make the patients feel good in spite of him taking up all kinds of difficulties to cure them. Like, that is the business of a preacher. His business is to remind us, like, generally the doctors take care of the body. But the religious leaders or spiritual teachers, they take care of the soul. The doctors cure the body, but they cure the disease of the soul. Just as a doctor is undergoing so much difficulties, but his business is to make everybody feel healthy and good.
So there's some inconvenience.
Some inconvenience, but you know, there is some joy when you see that the patients are getting clean, getting cured. There is a delight.
You know, you bring to mind a fascinating point when we talk about someone who's inspired in the medical field or as a teacher. Here in New York, we recently lost a very beloved actor, Philip Seymour Hoffman. The indications are that it was a drug overdose, a suicide. And I wonder, you're revered and loved not just as a profound scholar and teacher and practitioner, but also as a creative individual yourself. You're a producer of a 65-part television series. That's no small feat. You helped to design and oversee the construction of a beautiful temple in Ujjain. So you have that artistic side to you as well. And I wonder why it is that so often those people who have those instincts, those artistic intuitions or insights, their lives seem to be so tragic. I mean, not everyone, but so often people who go deeper inside a vision of the world, whether it be through research, medicine, science, whether it be through theater, acting, performing, music, something happens and there's a tragedy that is so often the companion to that. Why is that?
Well, just as you said, like, these are the individuals who go very deep within themselves, right? And they're profound in their thinking. They're elevated intellectually, and which is actually a sign of spiritual advancement. Unconsciously, they're spiritually advanced. Therefore, material achievements do not satisfy them. Just pure material achievements, just name, fame, money, you know, does not really make their heart content or satisfied. They aspire for something higher, and when they don't get that, because they are not aware of that side, that side of achievement, they become more and more frustrated. And as a result of that, at some point, some of them just want to get rid of themselves.
Oh, that's a fascinating insight. It suggests that if we're going to embark on a path of devotion and yoga, we better take it seriously, because a little bit of knowledge can be very dangerous.
Yeah. The main thing is that we have to know what is the goal of our existence. You see, like, here's the difference between a subhuman species and a human being. Subhuman species, like animals, reptiles, birds, they never question about, you know, who they are, what is the goal of their life. But a man does. And more awake he is, the more conscious he is, the deeper is that search. And that is why, unless and until that direction is given to them, you know, they remain, you know, they are searching for something. Like, you know, when you want something and don't get it, you naturally feel disappointed, you feel frustrated. And in most cases, that's what happens to them. Whereas you will not find a spiritually enlightened person, a spiritually advanced person committing suicide. Rather, he is, you know, he's extremely tranquil within himself. Like, as you're talking about, you know, quoting Karandar Prabhu, that, you know, he is thinking about, you know, like, so much hassle, so much, you know, trouble, and, you know, so much botheration in managing the temple and pushing the movement forward, taking care of the devotees. But in spite of all these that he was going through, there was an inner contentment, because he knew that what he was doing is really what he wanted to do. Whereas, just consider him. You know, he may have got his scene organized perfectly, but for how long?
Right.
At some point, he would have wondered, is that really what I wanted?
Yeah.
Is the goal of life just to earn money, have some position, and get some recognition and fame? You know, you get tired of it. Like, no matter how much money you have, at some point, you feel that, well, this is not what I wanted. And materially, that's always the case. We want something, but when we get it, we realize, no, this is not what I wanted. And we feel that whatever I wanted it by mistake. And when I got it, I realized that I didn't want it.
Mm-hmm. There's some kind of a letdown. It's a shopper's lament or something
right,
like that.
Yeah.
I want to ask one other question, then I'm just going to immediately open this up to you all. You're an initiating teacher. You're not just a teacher. You're an initiating guru, a Diksha guru. You award Diksha, a formal initiation, to your students, those who qualify. And that's been a hot topic around here. Mm-hmm. Part of the yoga culture that's emerged in America is that people take on a Sanskrit name. It's not the same thing. The awarding of a spiritual name is a very serious undertaking. There are responsibilities on both sides and so on. I wonder whether there is something that you might share with us about your experience as an initiating teacher in terms of, how to say this, and I want to say this as discreetly and respectfully as I possibly can. Out of compassion, has it occurred that perhaps you awarded initiation and then decided, you know, this person was not ready? Has there ever been an instance where someone should not have received initiation? What are the criteria that need to be respected, and what happens if those criteria are later not met?
Okay. You see, initiation is the process through which we pass the information, the spiritual knowledge, to the candidate or to the disciple. It's a process of, you know, teaching, education, right? Like one who is a student today becomes the teacher tomorrow, and he instructs his students. Then in course of time, his students become teachers, and they give. They pass the knowledge on to the next generation. So this is the kind of a line called disciplic succession. The spiritual knowledge that is coming down from the spiritual sky, spiritual world, is transmitted through this chain of teacher and student. So that's the basic concept of initiation. Like, now in this regard, I can say that, so when you want to learn something, what's the first consideration? Enrollment in the institution. So the formal initiation, the process of initiation is kind of the admission to the university. Mm. Right? But just the admission to the university is not good enough. One has to study. Then only he'll be able to master the subject. Now, as you're saying, that if the student is not qualified, then what happens? It's something like getting admitted to Oxford or Harvard and not attending the classes. What's the use of it? So the purpose of the initiation is to become eligible and willing to receive the spiritual wisdom, spiritual awareness. Therefore, yeah, this initiation is not just a matter of getting a Sanskrit name. It's a matter of committing yourself to a process to achieve something. And that achievement is the spiritual perfection.
If the knowledge is available through books, through recordings, through teachings, courses, I mean, we live in a digital age, you can, you know, go online to, you know, bhaktivedantacollege.org and sign up for a Bhagavad Gita course or a Nisopanishad course. What does that initiation do that simply learning the knowledge would not do on its own?
Well, as I said, like, initiation is the prerequisite or the primary consideration of getting admission to the institution. Like, as you're saying, like, you know, it's the knowledge is available. So why can't we get it from the books or from the internet and so forth? Mm-hmm. The thing is, Just like, you know, we can consider that, say, the books of medicine are available in the shop. If I buy the books, study the books, can I become identified or recognized as a qualified doctor? No. The books are not enough. Mm-hmm. To reveal the books, we need the teachers.
Okay.
So these are the two things, you know, must go hand in hand. Like the books must be there and the teachers must be there to reveal the books. Just the teacher without the books is bogus. And the books without teacher is useless.
So it's there, they're a complement.
They
go together.
We need, I mean, did we learn even the alphabets ourselves from the books?
No, you're right. There's always someone who teaches us.
We needed somebody to teach it to us.
Her name was Mrs. Klein. Boy, did I hate her. So let's open the room up to some questions here. We'll come to you, Michael, in a minute. Someone who doesn't have
a good
really
question.
Tricky questions. Nick.
maybe it's a tricky question because maybe I don't even know how to word this question, but I'm going to give it a shot. It's piggybacking off of what was said about us as human beings and our desire to learn where we came from and our origins. So what I thought about was this discovery, I think that just came out yesterday, of the observation of these primordial microwaves that existed maybe a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang.
It's front page in the Times.
Yeah, it is. And I can barely understand this like science myself, but what I've understood from, you know, my very introductory look into Gita and Vedic texts is that there are signals in these ancient texts that we do come from a place of multi-universes and things like that. And I was just wondering if maybe you could comment on some of these ancient texts that might confirm what these new quantum physics is teaching us now.
Yeah. Well, you see, you may have various observations of certain phenomena, right? But the bottom line of that is that somebody must have done it. Somebody must have designed it. Somebody must have organized it, right? Like, you know, say, for example, I may go to a motor car manufacturing factory and see certain machines are making gears. Now, just by seeing the machine making the cutting the gears is not the whole concept, right? The entire concept will come when we recognize that, behind this factory, there's a personality called Mr. Ford, who set the whole factory in motion or design. And as a result of that, not only the gears and, you know, motors are coming out, but the entire car is coming out because of his arrangement. So the point is, you know, I mean, behind everything we can say that we must see that there's a creator. Like, for example, if I ask, did somebody make it? What will be the natural answer? Yes. I can't say, I mean, it just dropped from nowhere, or there was some primordial soup, or there was some waves and that created that, you know. The wave may have been there, the primordial soup may have been there, but who is the person who took the soup and made this, right? So when you go like that, I mean, can we say, I mean, say this, I mean, we look around us, everything has, we must accept that there must have been a maker behind that. Now when we see the entire creation, then don't we also have to consider that behind that there is a personality who created that? And when we accept that point, then everything becomes perfectly organized, perfectly intellectually acceptable, right? So that is the Vedic answer. The Vedic answer is that there is a creator who created everything. And his creation has been perfectly described through certain literatures, and those literatures are called the Vedas. Like, for example, when a machine is designed or manufactured, along with that you get the operation manual, and when you go deeper, then you get the, you know, the entire concept how it came out from certain designs, right? The drawings are there, everything is there. So Vedas are presenting all those informations in a perfect way. And it is up to an intelligent person to just accept that and get the perfect answer to all the questions and the riddles that are troubling human mind today. Like, they may come up with so many concepts, but the question is, who was there trillions of years ago to witness that? I mean, they're simply depending upon speculation. And, you know, the problem with speculation is that it tends to lead you to a wrong concept. Like, there's an example of that, you know. Like, as you know, India was under the British rule. Many Britishers were actually staying in India, ruling the country. And so one Englishman came across a washerman who was washing the clothes. You see, in India, what they do, they take the cloth and mix it with soap, and then they hit it on a stone slab. And that's how they generally, the washerman, clean the clothes. So he wrote back to England saying that these people are so stupid that one day I saw a person who is trying to break a stone with a piece of cloth. So he saw that he is hitting the stone with the cloth. You see, his perception is that he thought, just by seeing, the immediate perception was that, you know, he is hitting the cloth, he is hitting the stone with the cloth. And he thought that actually this person is so stupid that he is trying to break the stone by hitting it with the cloth, with a piece of cloth. So the thing is, see, that there is a difference between the immediate perception and the actual reason. So, anyway, that would be my, you know, general consideration. See, the intelligent conclusion is that, yes, creation, this world has been created. And the creation came about by the divine arrangement of a personality who is endowed with an inconceivable ability and intelligence. You know, so simply the problem can, I mean, this quest can be answered.
Yeah. This, of course, is another repeating theme here at our Sunset Gita discussions. Everything seems fine, you know, the philosophy, karma, ahimsa, whatever, until you get to that one point where you start imposing a personal divinity behind creation, and that's when the room starts to kind of polarize, you know, to the left and to the right. And at that point, we're tapping into all kinds of subconscious and unconscious
negative speculations
and emotional reactions, negative emotional reactions. I thought it was fascinating, by the way, Nick, in that article, the last line of the article, if you go to the jump page, says, there was quoting an MIT physicist, I don't remember his name, saying, when you trace the cosmos back to its very earliest point, what you find is expansion. And I think there's somewhat circuitous logic there. You know, you're examining expansion, and you say, what we find is expansion, which is, I think, wordplay. If you go beneath the words, between the lines, what he's saying is, we're not going to talk about what happened before that moment of zero. You know, zero minus one. We're not going to talk about that because there we don't want to go. That's beyond our realm of responsibility, or it's certainly outside our comfort zone. So,
Since we're probing into that, maybe we can add a little bit to that also. Since you asked, what is the Vedic concept? I mean, I just gave you the ultimate Vedic concept. But the Vedas are not just, you know, just allowing us or forcing us to accept everything that they are presenting. Vedas are actually probing us, like provoking us to probe into things. Find out for yourself, right? And that is, you know, and that gives rise to various branches of philosophies. And one such branch of philosophy is called Shankar. Literally the word means analytical study. The analytical study, right? Analyze the material nature. And the way the Vedas are doing it is that first thing they're considering, there are five elements. Five elements are earth, which means solid substance, water means liquid, fire, air, and ether. And then they considered that we have five senses. And the interaction between the sense objects of the interaction between the elements and the senses give rise to five objects of the senses. Like, for example, the eyes interact with fire. The form is produced. Skin interacts with air. Touch is produced. Ears interact with ether. Sound is produced. Tongue interacts with water. Taste is produced. Nose interacts with earth. Smell is produced. So this is how five elements, five senses, giving rise to five objects of the senses. Then they consider that there are five working senses in our body with which we get involved in this world. They are hands, legs, anus, belly, and genitals. They are called the five working senses. Then, now, 5 4s are 20. Then they considered that there are three subtle elements. Those three subtle elements are mind, intelligence, and false ego. In Sanskrit, they're called man, buddhi, and ahankar. Then they considered, then they comes to the sum total of the elements with which everything has evolved. That is called mahatattva, from which everything evolved. The mind evolved, intelligence evolved, everything actually evolved from this mahatattva. Now see, the entire creation now has been analyzed to these 24 considerations. They didn't stop there. Then they considered that this is objective in nature. All these 24 considerations are objective. But the object cannot exist without the subject. Right? So who is the subject? I. I am, therefore it is. I am, therefore they are. Now see, this is how they're transcending the material and coming to the spiritual. Like the entire material creation have been analyzed through these 24 considerations, but I couldn't be found there. Therefore, I is non-material. Therefore, they're transcending matter coming to the platform of spirit or spiritual or non-material in whichever way you want to describe it. Something that is non-material, that is different from matter, beyond matter. So 25th consideration is I, and I am spiritual. I am not a product of this matter. And then they considered, they didn't stop at that also. Then they considered that eyes are minute and many. You have your eye, she has her eyes, he has his eyes, and so forth. All of us have our eyes, but those eyes are minute and many. So anything that is minute and many must have a source, an origin. So that origin is the supreme soul. We are spirit souls and he is the supreme soul. So that supreme soul is God. So see, they are establishing the existence of God, but they're not saying that, well, because we are saying it, you have to accept it. No. Just find out. Use your intelligence. Probe into it. But this is how you come to the conclusion. So this is the Vedas. And one thing we can very proudly say, that is how our spiritual master taught us. Prabhupada didn't want us to accept anything because he is saying. He said, use your intelligence, and if you have any question, ask questions. If you have any doubts, clarify the doubts. Okay, I just wanted to...
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have time for another couple of questions.
Michael,
waiting. Straight at the least.
My question comes from my class that we didn't really elaborate on, and is, can you elaborate a little bit more on the yoga ladder from animal to karmakanda, and through karmakanda applying jnana yoga to go to sakama yoga, and from sakama yoga to nishkam karma, and then from nishkam karma to bhakti? We like glanced over it in like 2 seconds in the lecture, and I just wanted a little bit more understanding of it.
Very good. Very good point. Yeah. Again, you see, like, this is another way of gradually, you know, coming from, transcending from one level to another. So now I will go into another branch of philosophy. You see, Vedas are dealing with 6 branches of philosophy. They are known as Purva Mimamsa or Karma Mimamsa, which means the preliminary conclusion or the concept of karmic action-reaction principle. Then it goes to Naya, or logic. Then it goes to Vaisheshika, or the structure of the universe, or atomic theory. And Vaisheshika leads to Shankha, which I just discussed. Shankha leads to Yoga. And Yoga leads to Uttar Mimamsa, or ultimate conclusion. So these are the 6 branches of philosophy. Now I'll just try to, as you said, like briefly try to explain these different, you know, grades of elevation. See, initially, everybody wants to enjoy. Now the Vedas are giving you the directions. Okay, fine, you want to enjoy. Now, this is the way to enjoy. And the simple consideration is, your good actions will lead to enjoyment, and wrong actions will lead to suffering. So that is the simple karmic principle. Good action leads to enjoyment, bad action leads to suffering. So, then the consideration is, like, in spite of enjoying, the Vedas are giving you the direction, anything that you desire, you can fulfill that desire. You want to become a rich man? Yes. Do this, perform these activities, you'll become rich. You want to become a king? You can become a king by performing these activities. You want to become the king of the entire earth planet? Fine. Perform these activities or yajnas, you can. And goes on. But the point is, ultimately one realizes that no matter how much I am trying to enjoy, no matter how much I am achieving, I am still not satisfied. Right? So then, that actually leads to the next branch. Why I am suffering. And the ultimate conclusion of that quest is, this world is meant for suffering. This world is full of misery. And this body is a wonderful instrument for receiving pain. Just consider, take any part of your body. Take any part of your body, say, your little finger. Consider how many different ways you can inflict pain on this little finger. millions of ways. Now you consider how many ways you can give pleasure to this little finger. Even if there is some proposal that this is how you can enjoy or give pleasure to this little finger, now you just compare it. Okay, fine, we'll give this pleasure. But say, somebody says, well, when I tickle my fingers, I get pleasure. Okay, tickle your fingers and at the same time, I'll cut your finger with a knife. Will anybody accept that proposal? So now, mind you, this principle applies to every single part of the body. And take your earlobes, take your hand, take your legs, take your foot. So the conclusion will always find that. There are hundreds of ways, thousands of ways that you can inflict pain on that part, but hardly you can give pleasure. So what it concludes then? That's why I say this body is a wonderful instrument for receiving pain. Then the question comes, you know, why am I suffering? What is this world actually where I am in? And ultimately it leads to the atomic theory. What we are perceiving, whether solid, liquid or whatever, is nothing but combination of atoms and molecules. Isn't it? Like, look at the wall. What is this wall? To us, to our senses, it's appearing to be solid. But you'll find, you know, huge intermolecular space between these, you know, between the molecules. Is giving rise to that concept that it's solid and so forth. So ultimately this world is made of atoms, but is giving rise in different frequency and different wavelength, you know, to different senses, it's appearing to be in a different ways. And then that leads to the analytical, let's find out what this world is. And that's the analytical study of Sankha, which I just mentioned. Now, through Sankha, they're coming into two considerations. Jivatma and Paramatma. Right? Minute soul and the supreme soul. Supreme soul is the source of all the minute souls. All the minute souls are the part and parcels of the supreme soul. Now, the parts existence, the utility of the part's existence, the meaning of a part's existence lies in its connection with the whole. This little finger is a part of my body. As a part of my body, this little finger is very, very valuable, very precious. But when the finger is cut off, separated from my body, it doesn't have any value. Immediately throw it away. So the utility or the purpose of our existence actually lies in our connection with the Supreme Soul or the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now then the question arises, then now that I have become separated from Him, how can I become connected to Him? Right? And that is giving rise to the next branch of philosophy called yoga. The yoga is actually, literally it means to become united, to become connected to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And there are eight different processes, eight different steps, Ashtanga Yoga. And the final point of that Ashtanga Yoga is Samadhi. Samadhi is the link, when the yoga, the link has been established with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Then the jiva's existence becomes meaningful. That he is Satchit Ananda. Spiritually, that the jiva, the spirit soul is Satchidananda, he goes back into that state. And that is the state of bliss. Now the consideration is, after seeing the Supreme Soul in Samadhi, what is the natural feeling of that spirit soul? When a small person comes across a very great personality, What is his natural feeling? What becomes his natural attitude? He automatically, his head bends down in awe and reverence, and he surrenders himself to him. So now yoga leads to that process of, or to the point of surrender. And that surrender is the beginning of devotion. Sharanagati or surrender leads to the ultimate conclusion of the Vedas, which is called Uttar Mimamsa, or final conclusion. The final conclusion is presented in Vedanta, which is elaborated in Srimad Bhagavatam, where the Lord's identity has been most profoundly established, and the jiva's link or with him through the process of surrender is established. So this is how, you know, as you say, like different branches of yogas ultimately leading to bhakti. So this is how it's leading to that point of bhakti, which is the ultimate conclusion.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful explanation. Thank you for that. Thank you so much. Well, I have time for maybe just one or two more questions. I saw your hand first. No? All right.
Before you went to Hare Krishna, when you have a goal in your life, from what you come up for the first 15, 20, 30 years, and like something isn't there, it's like it's missing, you don't feel happy, you don't feel anything, it's like you got the suffering in the world that you were talking about. Will you feel about the yoga and chanting Hare Krishna, would that heal with your intention of conquering through that?
Yes, yes. If the process is properly applied, the result will be there. Like chanting of Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, what it does actually, the first thing that the chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra does is cleanses our hearts. You see, our involvement or our entanglement in the material nature is due to the contamination in our hearts. Right? So those contaminations are defined in the form of lust, greed, anger, illusion, envy, and pride. So these are the impurities in the hearts, which is actually stemming from our misidentification, wrong identification, which is called false ego. Now, the chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, first thing that it will do is will purify or cleanse our hearts, right? And then from that point, you know, gradually different stages of development will take place. Like for example, when the heart is cleansed, then we'll become free from suffering condition. Our life will naturally become blissful. Our life will naturally become joyful. And so that is what for example, the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is actually the medicine for the soul. Just as by taking the proper medicine, the physical disease is cured, the soul's disease is cured by chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. And when it is applied properly, now there are certain impurities in chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. There are 10 different types of offenses. So when one chants the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, he should be careful not to commit those offenses. When this mantra is chanted offenselessly, then the result will automatically be there, which will begin from the point of cleansing of the mind.
So what would be an example of that improperly applying, improperly chanting the Maha Mantra?
Yeah. So one of the biggest problem is chanting the Maha Mantra but not accepting the Supreme Personality of Godhead as the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
So chanting the mantra but rejecting Krishna.
Rejecting Krishna. Yeah, that is the primary, you know, impurities. Then the other types of impurities are like those who are distributing this Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, finding faults in their activities. Is another very gross. Like say for example, the doctor is giving the medicine, but you don't have enough faith on the doctor, right? And then the second consideration is, you know, like not recognizing the Supreme Personality of Godhead as the Supreme Personality of God, which of course I mentioned as the first point. And this is how there are different types of offenses to the Holy Name, and one should guard himself against those offenses. Then the Hare Krishna Mahamantra will produce the result.
Yeah, we've had this discussion also here often, that there seems to be a kirtan culture that veers over into entertainment. And I'm wondering whether that would be an example of what you're talking about. If the chanting becomes not an act of surrender of the self, of prayer, but of a substitute for a dance tune or something. Is that an improper application?
We can look at it in both ways. Because they're chanting the Maha Mantra, it'll have its benefit. Mm-hmm. Right? But at the same time, to develop, to derive the desired benefit, one should have the proper understanding.
Right, so that get the this full benefit.
Is to derive the full, yes. Yeah, that's why I say desired benefit, yeah. is to recognize this Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is actually a prayer to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It is a prayer, appeal to Him, my Lord, you are all attractive. So please allow me to become engaged in your service. Allow me to become attracted to you and express that attraction through my love for you. And let me express that love for you through the Sutam service for you. So please allow me to, in this way, become free from our material bondage and go back to your lotus feet.
Thank you. We have time perhaps for one more question and then we'll start the...
Sudhakar, you had a question?
I have two options. I'll ask later.
Okay. If anybody has any questions. Yes?
In the practice of devotion, when is it that you see that a devotee is ready to be initiated? What do you see in the devotee when he comes to you?
Yeah. You see, the Vedic scriptures give a very clear direction towards that. It says that the teacher or guru should see the student or disciple for 1 year, test him for 1 year. Similarly, the student also should check out the teacher for 1 year. And then when both are convinced, right, and both are actually eager, then the initiation can take place. Okay, you see now in ISKCON, our movement has grown so vast all over the world.
ISKCON, by the way, for those of you who may not be familiar with that acronym, is the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, which is the formal institution that our teacher, Prabhupada, founded back in 1966. In one little storefront on 2nd Avenue, and since then it's become this worldwide society.
Yeah. Okay. So, so here the consideration is that one should practice the process sincerely to show his earnestness, to prove his intention, and. First consideration is to chant the mantra, Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, a certain number of rounds in a bead, which takes about 2 hours' time that one must dedicate himself to. And then one must abstain from wrong actions. That is detrimental to spiritual progress. One is eating meat. The other is taking intoxicants. The other one is indulging in inappropriate activities like illicit sex. Sex for procreation between husband and wife is the actual purpose of sex. But sexual relationship outside of marriage is forbidden, and gambling or involving in activities that are based on falsity or cheating or lying. So So these are the four principles that one has to follow according to the Vedic understanding. And there are, you know, profound reasons behind that also. I'm not taking, you know, like I'm just giving a brief answer to that. Like, why should one do that? There is a scientific reasons behind that. So these are the, you know, two basic prerequisites for getting initiated in our institution. And a serious, sincere soul is expected to come up to that standard. Thank you.
If someone wanted to receive more of your teachings, do you have books or a website, or is there some way that people could contact you if they to do so?
Sure. My email address, and there's a website also.
And what is that website?
Website is bhakti.charu.swami, www.bhakti.charu.swami.
B-H-A-K-T-I, bhakti dot...
C-H-A-R-U Charu dot Swami.
Dot Swami.
Yeah. So that's the website. And
Bhakti dot Charu, C-H-A-R-U dot Swami. Yeah?
And my email address is the same, bhakti.charu.swami@gmail.com.
Now you have his private email. Do not abuse that. I beg you. Please don't send it.
What about the people on podcast then?
Yes, of course. We are going to be making our discussion here today available as a podcast.
Okay.
We begin sometimes our Tuesday gatherings with an arti ceremony. And are you going to be doing arti? Ian, you're up here, huh?
Yeah,
terrific. Wonderful. And you're welcome to stand and join us a little closer to the altar. I see Michael is there, ready with the basket to receive your donations.
Please remember to donate.
And after the artik, which is just a few minutes long, there's we have some prasadam to share with people, Michael.
I didn't make Julie and Ian made prasadam.
Oh, thank you very much. So that's like a fruit salad or something. So I hope you'll stay for a few minutes and have a handful or two of our fruit salad prasadam and meet some of the people here this evening who have come to greet Bhakti Charu Swami. So thank you again. Would you join me in thanking Bhakti Charu Swami?
I must thank you all also for giving me this opportunity, especially Jogeshwar Prabhu, who is my very dear godbrother and friend.
Thank you.
So, for giving me this opportunity.
And well, I hope you'll come back again very soon.
Sure.
Thank you.